dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas, at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That's what I call it. I think it best reflects what we are dealing with, what the stakes are. And a man who understands it perhaps as well as anyone, both the stakes, the gravity of the threat to our freedoms, and the necessity for concerted and effective action to protect the free world, is, I'm very pleased to say, our guest for this full hour. He is Raymond Ibrahim. He is a man who has distinguished himself by his writings and his public speaking and his other analyses of the various challenges, notably in two books, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians, a subject we will talk about at length with him, I know, and also The Al-Qaeda Reader. Raymond is a Shulman Fellow at the highly regarded David Horowitz Freedom Center and an Associate Fellow at the also highly regarded Middle East Forum, among many other distinctions. Raymond Ibrahim, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you back.
Well, thank you for having me, Frank, and thank you for the kind introduction.
Well, it's heartfelt and well-deserved, I think, and let's prove it to our audience by walking through some of these various thorny issues that so many of us are confused about. And I'm sorry to say it seems to be particularly in evidence at the moment inside the United States government. We've had the president declare what amounts to, I guess, war on this outfit. He insists on calling it ISIL. It calls itself the Islamic State. We've had the House and now the Senate voting on resolutions to authorize the use of military force against ISIL elements in Syria and arm the so-called moderate rebels there. Help us understand, Raymond, what the ground truth is about this outfit, this Islamic State, and most especially maybe perhaps start with, is it unique? Is it altogether different from the other elements of the global jihad that I at least believe we are confronting as well?
Yeah, sure, Frank. Well, regarding that last point, it is different in one sense in that it has become successful. So that is to say that all these groups and organizations and Islamists and, you know, different tribes, quote-unquote nonviolent stealth ones, and then the jihadi ones, they're all working for the same goal, which is, of course, the establishment of a caliphate, or sometimes a lesser thing, an emirate, or some sort of, you know, little concentration such as what the Taliban had, for example, in Afghanistan. But this, of course, is all unprecedented in the modern era because it's the caliphate, or so they tout it and portray it. And many Muslims, in fact, are looking to it as that. You can see it as radical Islam come to fruition, or the culmination of what they want. This is it. What you're seeing, the beheadings, the crucifixion, the enslavements, the rapes, the church bombings, and so forth. This is all the ultimate culmination of what you see from all these different groups that act in different ways. And so to go to your other point, however, about, you know, the White House and the Obama administration and just really politicians in general, because it's the same theme all around from Western, you know, in Europe and in America and so forth. They all want to very clearly and emphatically separate the Islamic State from Islam. And, you know, the problem with that is if we're in a war and we're involved in conflicts, the first thing we have to have is clarity and truth and forthrightness from our leaders. And so to make a statement as he did when he came recently a few days ago and said that, let's be perfectly clear, ISIL, that is the Islamic State, is not Islamic, that, of course, is ludicrous. Because look at its name. I mean, they call themselves Islamic. They follow all of the teachings and the paradigms. And so it's all there, and we're not getting the truth. And so here we are yet again trying to wage a war without any proper context, with false ideas. He even tried to attribute their violence to grievances. Once again, the grievance paradigm that supposedly ISIL or ISIS or however you want to call them are killing Yazidis and killing Christians and slaughtering Shias. And as they do that, they cite Islamic teachings. All that supposedly is our fault once again. So you can see we have a completely flawed paradigm of how to approach it. And as long as that continues, you're going to see the same sorts of things. A decade after 9/11, we are actually in a much worse state. And why is that? Because since 9/11, we've been saying Islam's a religion of peace. They have nothing to do with Islam, et cetera, et cetera. And when you do that, you see what's going on. You see what happens is basically this. Now we have a caliphate that's functioning.
Yeah. You know, I'm reminded, Raymond, that Sun Tzu, the famous Chinese strategist, I think 5,000 years or so ago, made the obvious point that you can't defeat an enemy you don't know. And it does seem to me, as you just were saying, we've been putting to the test the proposition that you can for the past 13 years, at least arguably back to 1979, when Iran began its jihadist attacks on this country with the rise of the Ayatollah and his team. It does seem to me that this is really the starting point for any possible solution to this this menace, and yet it seems absolutely lacking. To what do you attribute that, Raymond? It's often said it's political correctness, but my sense is there's more at work here than that. But what's your judgment?
Well, I completely agree with you, Frank. It's a lot more than political correctness. I think it's something that's so ingrained right now in the sort of Western progressive psyche. I think this idea of, multiculturalism has become so ingrained, and it's part of it's an article of faith, basically, amongst so many people in the West. Multiculturalism, every culture has its own, unique contribution. Everyone, but no one's better than the other. That's all relative, et cetera, et cetera. So to actually come up and say flat out something like this particular religion, this particular civilization teaches X, Y, and Z, and X, Y, and Z would be things that are actually frowned upon, such as the beheading and slaughtering and executing and raping. And to say that, I think it completely contradicts. I think we're in the level of faith and religion here. And I'm not talking about Islam. I'm talking about the Western progressive mentality. It's a sort of article of faith, and it cannot be shaken. And it doesn't matter how much facts you give me, how much data you bring forth or statistic. You can show me them say Islamic State or any other number of Muslims saying, quoting the Quran about beheading and slaughtering. It doesn't matter, because once I say that and agree that, yes, let's say Islam is an inherently intolerant faith, so much of the entire edifice of my worldview, that is to say, if I'm a progressive, starts crumbling, because that is a cornerstone, that's a premise. So I think it's there's a very philosophical underpinning as to why they can't embrace reality.
Yeah. Perhaps a small quibble, but maybe it's a substantive difference between us, is I would ascribe this not so much to Islam necessarily as to Sharia, though I will freely assert that the authorities of Islam say they're one and the same. It's just that there are, as you know, Raymond Ibrahim, millions of Muslims beyond who say they're not or don't know what Sharia is or don't practice their faith in accordance with it. But for the purposes of this discussion, I think it's fair to say that those who are leading this faith and leading these jihadist movements all believe that they have, in fact, the direct line to God as a result of their faithful adherence to Sharia. But what's so striking, and you sort of alluded to it, that we find here in the West, and particularly here in the United States, it seems, of late, the left, the progressives, if you will, embracing or at least apologizing for or excusing or otherwise, maybe even enabling these jihadists, these Sharia-adherent folks, even though the first people put to the knife were they to come to power would be all of the communities that make up the modern left in this country, the feminists and the Jews and the apostates or atheists or artists or homosexuals. I mean, it just goes on and on. And it is unbelievable that we find them somehow as, the leading edge of the effort to accommodate these guys. What's up with that?
Well, that's the grand irony, of course, just as you delineated, which is basically the greatest apologists are the ones who would be the first at the tip of the sword. I think one of the main reasons they don't get that is because they physically, literally are not, because, we're oceans away from what's happening over there. So, a feminist in America can sit and gripe about, how bad an American woman, for example, has it, and she won't say anything about what's happening over there, because of sort of what I alluded to, this sort of progressive idea, which if you say that, then you're finger, you know, but also B, because she's not there. It's not her problem in the end. She's not
wearing the mobile jail, as our friend Phyllis Chesler calls it. Raymond Ibrahim is our guest from, among other places, the David Horowitz Freedom Center, where he is the Shulman Writing Fellow. He is also with the Middle East Forum, the author of two really important books about which we're going to talk more, notably the one on Christians and their fate in the hands of these guys. And we'll do all of that and more as our special hour-long program with Raymond Ibrahim continues straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
Are you looking to hire an IT specialist or a logistics expert, a medical technician, or a security professional? Well, there are some very qualified candidates out there, America's wounded warriors. These men and women returning from battle are eager to get back to life at home and a good job. Some have wounds you can see, and some have wounds you can't see, like post-traumatic stress disorder. For these accomplished professionals, Wounded Warrior Project has developed the Warriors to Work program, a career counseling service that helps wounded warriors translate their military experience to the civilian workplace. These warriors have world-class job skills and a unique perspective on teamwork. And to ensure proper placement for each individual, Wounded Warrior Project works with employers to find just the right candidate for the job. When your company is looking to hire talented, highly trained employees, contact Wounded Warrior Project at findwwp.org. Welcome home the brave.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, joined, I'm really thrilled to say, by a man of great capacity when it comes to understanding the nature of the war for the free world and its most immediate enemy, sadly, the Islamists. He is Raymond Ibrahim. He is the author of Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians, and also the Al-Qaeda Reader. You can find his work elsewhere as well, including at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, where he is the Shulman Fellow. Raymond, one of the things that one of your colleagues at the Horowitz Freedom Center, the author of Jihad Watch, Robert Spencer, has pointed out in a marvelous new video, and we'll have this posted at our securefreedom.org website for folks who want to see it. He's talked about, with several others, the phenomenon in the present challenge posed by the Islamic State, that they have announced the creation of a caliphate, which he and his stars of this video argue is a qualitatively different problem than the so-called defensive jihad that the bin Ladens and so on argued they were engaged in heretofore. Talk, if you would, a little bit about that doctrinally within Islam and Sharia and what difference it might make in terms of how this thing is getting ramped up against us.
Sure, it is a good difference, and there is something of a dichotomy in how jihad is understood in that sense. So what we have been so far dealing with, terrorism and so forth, as it's articulated in Islamic doctrine, or at least as the way Al-Qaeda and all these other people plausibly make the argument, fits into the defensive jihad mode, which actually becomes, according to Islamic teaching, a individual duty, just like prayer and fasting is for Muslims. It becomes an individual duty once non-Muslims invade what is Islamic territory. So supposedly, and this is why, for example, Al-Qaeda always portrayed or its attacks such as 9/11 as reciprocal treatment, and we're attacking you because you attacked us, and so forth.
Raymond Ibrahim is our guest. We're talking about the nature of the threat we're facing from these global jihadists. And you were just helping explicate for us, Raymond, how this works in terms of the Sharia doctrine, the nature of the jihad, whether it's offensive or defense. And please carry on.
Sure. So defensive jihad, as you know, just to sum up again, is basically whenever an infidel, quote unquote, attacks Islamic lands, then it's everyone's duty to fight them back any which way they can. It could be through terrorism, through funding terrorists, or you know, as it's called, stealth jihad and subverting the infidel infrastructure and so forth. Offensive jihad. Now, this is the true and historical meaning of jihad, which has admittedly been on the wane for a few centuries, and it may be coming back now. So doctrinally, offensive jihad is when you have a caliphate, as we did on the death of the Islamic prophet Muhammad. The job of the caliphate is to constantly expand its territories by bringing under its sway non-Muslim lands and enforcing Islamic Sharia law on them. And then they have the choice to convert to Islam and be part of the team, or keep their religions, their Christians and Jews and so forth, and pay tribute and live as basically third-class citizens, or it's the sword. Now, what's interesting about this is Osama bin Laden himself, the man of grievances, who, you know, if you only followed Western mainstream media, which, of course, follow Al Jazeera, which, of course, is an Islamist propaganda mouthpiece, listening to him, it was just one grievance after another against America, including for not signing the Kyoto Protocol, if you can believe that. So it was Israel, Kyoto Protocol, any number of things, using nuclear warfare and so forth. But in his writings to Arabs in Saudi Arabia in Arabic, which I translated for the Al-Qaeda Reader, he made emphatically clear that all grievances aside, it is our Islamic duty based on offensive jihad when the time comes to go and conquer and give them the three choices: convert, live as third class in me, or die. And now that's exactly what we're seeing with the Islamic State, because it has proclaimed itself a caliphate, it has a self-styled caliph, and so it now fits the Islamic doctrinal prerequisite of waging an offensive jihad, which is the caliphate. And that's why we're seeing, you know, so when people tell you, for example, the Islamic State is much worse than Al-Qaeda, there's a reason for that, because they've actually reached a higher state of accomplishment. They have a caliphate, and so naturally it's going to get worse, because now when you get to that point, and then you expand and you start slaughtering left and right, as we're seeing.
And I want to talk with you a little bit about that, because I think it's important for us to calibrate on these guys. But Raymond, just to pick up on the point you've just made, we are told that these guys are not just more accomplished than Al-Qaeda. They've achieved a conquest of territory, and they've now formalized that with the declaration of this caliphate and the designation of this Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi as the caliph. But that they're more extreme in terms of their practice of violence in the furtherance of their jihadist objectives than Al-Qaeda. And they've been repudiated by Al-Qaeda and so on. Talk a little bit about where the truth lies on that score.
Well, the truth lies in that it's sort of related to what I was just saying, is they are more extreme in a sense because they actually can be, from an Islamic point of view, because they have a caliphate. If you have a caliphate, of course, hand in hand with expanding, is enforcing Sharia, is strict Sharia law, hence enslavement of infidels, hence beheadings. Hence mass massacres, because this is now an Islamic state, whereas Al-Qaeda as an organization, as a group, is not obligated or even really, aside from obligated, it doesn't have the capacity to say we are in charge, we enforce Sharia law. So in a way, you can almost say they have dispensations.
But they were engaged in beheadings, and they were engaged in mass executions, and they were engaged in, I think, crucifixions and so on. So is in terms of the just the sheer violence, is there a dime's worth of difference between them, other than perhaps, as you say, the Islamic State has the capacity to do it on a larger scale than Al-Qaeda?
That's the main point, larger scale. However, as far as, you know, actually doing it, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab in Somalia, Boko Haram in Nigeria, you know, one can go on and on with all these organizations. And keep in mind, these organizations are from different countries, different races, different languages. The only thing they have in common really is that they call themselves Islamic, and they say they're following Islamic Sharia. So, for instance, in Islamic State, one of the things it's been doing, which has gotten some media attention, is enslavement of women and infidel women, Yazidis, Christians, and so forth, and selling them on slave markets. Well, Boko Haram, we remember, did that very recently, abducting some 300 primarily Christian girls and selling them on the. And you can leave the Islamic world. Let's go to the UK. You know, there was that sex scandal in, I believe, Rotherham, and it was all run by Muslims. And it was, you know, indigenous native British teenagers or some as young as 11. And you see the same pattern. You see the same justification. One of the Pakistani men who was doing this, one of these young girls, said, "This is what we do in our country all the time." And in fact, you go to Pakistan and you see Hindus and Christians are constantly being abducted by teams and gangs of men and being raped. So you find these patterns, and, on the one hand, I definitely do disagree with you. I mean, agree with you in what I think you're saying, which is basically the Islamic State is really not that much more violent than all these other organizations. It does have, more legitimacy to be violent, one may say. But if you really look at what's been happening, I mean, some of these places have been as bad, if not even worse.
But I kind of think of it, Raymond, as kind of a mafia war. The guys are each struggling to become the Uber Führer or the Capo di Tutti or whatever they call him. But the it's not that they disagree over the means or even the objectives. In fact, they're the same objectives. They just want to be the guy in charge. We're going to talk more about how this is playing out in places like, but not exclusively limited to, Iraq and Syria, with Raymond Ibrahim of the Middle East Forum and the David Horowitz Freedom Center, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Hugh Hewitt keeps the Constitution first.
That's what the left is about right now. Not about this or that.
Regulation or restriction.
Not about keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally disabled. It's about attacking the Constitution. And by the way, you cannot mess with the Second Amendment without messing with the First and the Fourth and the Fifth and the Tenth. You either respect the Constitution or you don't.
The Hugh Hewitt Show. Weeknights at 6 after Michael Medved at 3 on 1260 WRC. New Choice. Intelligent Talk.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On their way out the door this week to hit the campaign trail full-time, lawmakers made a short detour. They approved President Obama's plan to wage war in Syria. Majorities in both houses of Congress bought the administration's line that it can tell who are the moderate rebels there. We are assured that if armed and trained by us, they can provide the boots on the ground in the fight against the Islamic State, so we won't have to. Unfortunately, virtually all such rebels are Islamists fighting alongside al-Qaeda. Most have pledged loyalty to assorted global jihadists. They often lose or surrender weapons we give them, and training any actual moderates in immoderate Saudi Arabia is a formula for their radicalization and disaster. And so is President Obama's strategy more generally. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement, and how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, wherever the mission takes us, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are continuing a superb conversation with one of the most knowledgeable men in America about matters involving the global jihad, what we're up against, who is perpetrating it, the manifestations of its efforts to force all, and I mean all of us, to submit to its dictates. He is Raymond Ibrahim, in addition to his positions at the David Horowitz Freedom Center, where he is a Shulman Fellow and an Associate Fellow at the Middle East Forum. He is also a Writing Fellow with the Hoover Institution, a man of many parts. His books include Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians, and also the very highly regarded The Al-Qaeda Reader. Raymond, again, welcome. The thing maybe we could pick up on in terms of your recent writings, you have been chronicling what this group, the Islamic State, and for that matter, others of these jihadists have been doing to Christians. Talk a little bit about the kind of behavior they've exhibited towards them, and is it really appreciably different from what they have in mind for everybody, basically, Christians, Jews, and Zoroastrians, and anybody else?
Well, to take up that last point, it's not different at all. In fact, in Crucified Again, I concluded by pointing out that, you know, I focused on Christians as a paradigm of what happens to minorities under Islamic sovereignty. But as I concluded in the book, this is really what's in store for all non-Muslims. If these such of groups and this sort of ideology, wherever it takes way, what happens to Christians is going to happen to the Jews and to the Yazidis and to the atheists and to the, you know, all these people fall under the same umbrella. But what these groups have been doing, of course, is making the life of Christians a living hell. You know, we all heard about the Yazidis, and I was happy about that, that it made it to the mainstream media. But it was strange for me because worse has been happening to Christians by these same groups for so long, and you never hear anything. It's almost as if, I believe, the mainstream media feels, you know, if we say something about Christians and Muslims are attacking them, then that's the biggest taboo thing. But if it's some other sort of esoteric or exotic group like Yazidis, then we can talk about that. But the fact is, what happened to the Yazidis has been happening to the Christians for so much longer. And again, as we were discussing earlier, not just by the Islamic State, but all around the Islamic world, by you know, Muslim groups and persons of different races, colors, languages, cultures, socioeconomic conditions, and so forth, you're seeing the same exact pattern from churches being bombed and destroyed, and then you get the Islamists or so, or whoever comes up saying, well, it's in Islamic teachings, or from, you know, killing or raping their women and taking them and enslaving them. And you have politicians, a Kuwaiti politician, saying, yeah, why don't we do that? It's part of Islamic teaching. That would actually help preserve the morality of Muslim men so they don't have to sleep around. They can just go buy an infidel slave. I mean, we have these as texts, and she even pointed out this particular anecdote. She said, go in the Chechnya war, since you people like blonde-haired, blue-eyed infidels, go and, you know, there's surely Russian girls who are captured. Bring them here to Kuwait and let's sell them. And what's wrong with that? That's perfectly Islamic. And that sort of thing's just happening all around the Islamic world, and it's happening to Christians, and it's happening to other minorities, and that's the whole point of the book. And just one other point about that book is I tried to show the continuity that what we're seeing today fits a pattern that goes back 1,400 years ago in the Islamic world to Christians and to others. And so this is why, to me, it's so amazing for someone like Obama to come up and say, this is not Islamic. In fact, it is very Islamic. It's 1,400 years of Islam, and what we see today perfectly mirrors what we saw yesterday.
And again, what's so troubling about this is that while you will find parts of the world in which this has not been, generally speaking, at least the practice of Islam, the roots of the faith, the authorities of the faith, the traditions of the faith clearly are imbued with this kind of behavior. And for someone to call it not Islamic, Raymond, what do you make of that? Is it just this political correctness, or surely this president, who, let's face it, grew up in the Muslim faith, has to have a clearer idea of what some of these practices are than this comment would suggest. And I'm reminded that, you know, David Cameron has now repeatedly said, you know, this stuff has nothing to do with Islam. And George W. Bush said it as well. And I just wonder, there seems to me to be another explanation at work here, and that I personally find more convincing than just they don't know, or they're just hewing to some sort of political correctness. And that is that they are under the influence of people who are deliberately misleading them about these traditions and practices, and find it expedient to keep us completely confused and muddle-headed about the nature of the threat we're facing. I mean, with some of it, I think we do bear a responsibility for failing to have studied or learned this ourselves, but also I think it's a failure of having been too willing to embrace or take tutelage from or otherwise be advised by people, including Muslim brothers, in fact.
Well, you see, that's just it, Frank. When it comes down to this question, you know, and all these politicians from Obama to Bush, Cameron, and so forth, and so many other people, you know, it comes down to really one of two things when I hear something like Islam, you know, Islamic State is not Islamic. Either this person is woefully ignorant, or they're just lying. You know, there's absolutely no other way for it, you know, to understand. It has to be one or the other. And like you pointed out, these people are, in fact, I believe someone like George Bush was very much misguided by, you know, these quote-unquote moderate Islamists who are, you know, proliferate all around Washington and in various places. And then, of course, there's that nice message where you don't want to make Muslims look so bad. You know, they're our allies. And if you say Islam's like that, then they're all going to get violent after all. So then, you know, there's all these kind of motivators that are put forth, which are pseudo-motivators, because, in fact, that doesn't do anything. When you come up and you say a false statement, that doesn't placate them, and it doesn't enlighten us. So, you know, there's a lot of factors behind it. But when you come to Obama, as you point out, I know with him, it's not ignorance. I know he knows exactly what Islam is. You know, this is a man who grew up in Islamic countries. He went to madrasas. You know, he knows what this religion is. And yet he's sitting here telling us this has nothing to do with Islam. And, you know, so that we're getting a direct lie. And, you know, to go back to this idea of Sun Tzu and, you know, knowing your enemy, it just, I feel not enough policymakers and analysts are stepping back and looking at the big picture and seeing that everywhere that the United States goes in the name of democracy to help so-called moderates and so forth, we get basically the Islamic State. We forget, you know, it's been over a decade ago, the United States liberated Iraq. Now, 10 years later, after all that money, after all the lives that have been spent there, Obama said, and I believe 2008, okay, we've got victory. He pulled them out. And as Bush even predicted right before he left, if we do that, well, you know what? Al-Qaeda is going to take over, and we're going to see massacres on a grand scale. And that's exactly what we're doing. So did this man, Obama, not know that, you know, this is going to happen? Did he just have so much faith in Islam, which I find hard to believe, since he should know that this sort of thing does happen? But he pulled them out. He said victory is declared. And now a few years later, we have the most, you know, atrocious Islamic organization, a caliphate, right where we went supposedly and spent so much time, effort, money, and lives. And to me, if you step back and look at that, I think that's just amazing and speaks volumes about what's really happening behind the scenes.
And yet, do you sense, having now seen something of the debate in the House and Senate, Raymond Ibrahim, and you know, let's face it, an authorization out of the Congress for the president to proceed with a war that seems exceedingly narrowly focused, to my mind, this Islamic State, that we have people in government anywhere, really, most especially in a loyal opposition, who understand what you've just said, who understand accurately what we're up against?
Well, the thing is, and I feel there's this sort of myopia that just infects Washington. And it may be because, you know, a president's 10 years, 4 years or 8 years or whatever. So they only think about what's going to work for my time, what's going to look good for my 4 or 8 years. But the measures they take enable and empower these forces down the line. And that's exactly what we're seeing. I mean, it's just mind-boggling. The Islamic State, this organization, comes into the area where the United States, which has the most powerful military in the world and has all this intelligence and all these resources, and 10 years of the United States there, we end up with the Islamic State, where in all these other Islamic countries, we don't have that because just the indigenous dictators are keeping it in check. You know, just kind of, I don't know if they see that.
I don't either. And let's talk a little bit more in our final segment of this very special program with Raymond Ibrahim of the David Horowitz Freedom Center and the Middle East Forum and an associate of the Hoover Institution as well. To get clear as to what we need to be doing now in order to get this right, notably including how we deal with some of those totalitarian forces elsewhere in the Middle East, some of whom are holding these guys in check, some of whom are holding their coats. More on that with Raymond Ibrahim straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
An inspector general serves as an independent watchdog in each federal agency, promoting integrity and efficiency while rooting out fraud, waste, and abuse of authority in our government. Several important U.S. agencies have not had an IG for years, including the State Department, which has been without an IG for 5 years. During a constant wave of scandals in Washington, D.C., the newly published IG handbook by yours truly, Joseph E. Schmitz, couldn't be more timely. Every IG takes an oath to support and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. By exposing fraud, waste, or abuse through audits, IGs satisfy the constitutional mandate that a regular statement and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. The new IG handbook explains by what authority and for what purpose an inspector general does what he or she does on behalf of we, the people. Find the Inspector General Handbook on Amazon.com.
I was diagnosed with PTSD. I got out and was sort of on my own.
Since 2003, more than 103,000 service members have been diagnosed with PTSD. Hope for the Warriors focuses not on what happened, but what happens next. Don't let them be forgotten. You can help restore hope to our military families.
My wife and my son are affected by combat, too.
Visit hopeforthewarriors.org today.
People know that they can turn to them and trust them.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I lost my arm.
I lost my legs.
But you can't see what I lost. Over 625,000 vets are suffering from traumatic brain injury
and post-traumatic stress. They're the wounds you can't see.
But with your help, we can expose the invisible wounds of war.
And get these veterans the help they desperately need.
100% of your donation goes toward building treatment centers. Help heal the invisible wounds of war. Donate at makeitvisible.org.
I had no choice the news that was given to me on August 2nd.
Gold Star mom, Debbie Lee.
But I did have a choice how I responded.
In August 2006, Mark Allen Lee became the first Navy SEAL to lose his life in Iraq.
I chose to put on Mark's boots, pick up his weapon, and stay in the fight for our troops and their families.
And America's Mighty Warriors was born.
Mark's name meant Mighty Warrior. And he definitely lived up to his name.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org, you'll find Mark's last letter home.
Read it, and you'll know what AMW's about.
It's about service to active duty members of the military and their families.
Including care packages, visits, and more.
It's about supporting the wounded and the people who love them.
It's about the Gold Star family.
Special retreats, concerts, Mother's and Father's Day events. To let them know they're loved and not forgotten. Donations are tax deductible and go directly where they're needed.
Read Mark's last letter home.
And just as he inspired his mom, let Mark inspire you to some random acts of kindness of your own.
At AmericasMightyWarriors.org.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at DailyCaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anysoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Well, we're in our last segment. The time has flown by with Raymond Ibrahim, a noted author and public speaker and go-to guy on matters involving the Middle East and Islam in particular. He is the author of two very important books, notably of late, one, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians, and of course the sort of the all-purpose redoubtable, the Al-Qaeda Reader, very much in demand in places that have a willingness to see what we are in fact up against. And Raymond, you've really laid that out, I think, very well in the course of our previous three segments. Talk a little bit about what you would be recommending at this point U.S. policymakers do in the face of what is in fact not simply a threat from this Islamic State, bad as it is, but indeed a true global jihad on the march at the moment?
Well, first, you know, as I alluded to earlier, a little honesty and a little forthrightness to the American people about the nature, the ideology of this enemy. You know, it's not to say that you have to say, this is what Islam teaches. I'm not saying that, but you shouldn't say this is not Islamic, as if it's some kind of organization that has absolutely nothing to do with Islam. That's, of course, absurd. If you want to articulate it, this is, you know, radical Islam, or this is what Sharia-based Islam is, that's fine by me. That's definitely an excellent start, but we don't even have that. We can't even, in the Defense Department's and intelligence person, I can't even use terms like Islamist or jihadi. They just talk about amorphous, vague terrorism. And so, of course, you know, again, that Sun Tzu element, let's start knowing who the enemy is, what their motivation is, what they're trying to do. So that's the one big thing I would advocate for. Another thing is, enough of this Arab Spring guise, which still seems to exist, this idea of let's get rid of these evil, you know, secular dictators, and I'm not defending them at all, but I will defend them when we're putting actually something that's much worse and more hostile, not just to the indigenous people, but to us ourselves. And so this idea of helping, you know, quote-unquote moderate rebels who for some reason always end up being al-Qaeda-type Islamic State groups, whether in Libya or in Syria or in Iraq, as we're seeing. So this idea of helping these guys, I would, you know, let's stop helping them. And if anything, let's help the really define a moderate organization or a secular organization, whoever that may be, and help them fight them. So, you know, there's a lot of steps we can take, but it seems like we're doing the exact, not only are we not taking them, we're just suppressing them and doing the antithesis of them. So we're helping the Islamists. We're eliminating any form of intelligence to try to understand or put into context who these groups are. And to go back to that earlier point, you know, 10 years later, we're so much worse off. That's what's going to happen. 10 years from now, if we continue down this road, it's going to be significantly worse than it is right now.
Yeah. And, you know, Raymond, one of the other pieces of this, it seems to me, is that if we are mapping out a program for countering this ideology, I use the term they use, they call it Sharia, it would seem to me we could do a lot worse than to think about the means by which the United States mobilized basically all instruments of national power to defeat another totalitarian ideology with global ambitions that sought very explicitly our destruction, namely Soviet communism. And as you know, it was my old boss, Ronald Reagan, who articulated it and executed that strategy back in the 1980s. And I just wonder whether you have looked, for example, at National Security Decision Directive 75, which really mapped out the economic warfare element and the political warfare element and the intelligence operations and the proxy forces that would be used to subvert the Soviets and the delegitimation and so on, and whether that wouldn't be a pretty good roadmap for what we need to do now, having clarity, as you say, about the nature of the enemy and that it is an ideologically driven adversary and it isn't confined to just the Islamic State, in order to try to counter what we're up against at the moment.
I think that would be an excellent step. I think you're absolutely right. If you take that sort of paradigm that was used to combat communism and, you know, substitute it for the Sharia-based sort of ideology, that would be an amazing first step. Of course, the first problem you're going to encounter is that, you know, everyone's going to tell you, well, Islam is a religion. But, of course, your point is it's Sharia. It's a way of life, and that's exactly what the word Sharia means. It means a pathway, a road, an ideology. And, you know, if that could be done, that right there would probably be the first major step to just completely solving this whole situation.
At the very least, Raymond Ibrahim, it allows you to help differentiate Muslims who are a problem from Muslims who aren't, at least not at the moment, and give a basis upon which you can help and, you know, empower and legitimate those who aren't. And I commit it to you and to our listeners, of course, as one of the things that ought to be in this debate at a moment when we seem to be sort of blindly, you know, plunging into a very narrowly construed war, especially in Syria, where I must say I can't make head or tails out of which side are we on and who we're going to arm and how we can have any confidence that those arms and training and so on won't wind up, you know, being used against us and our friends.
Absolutely. One of the problems, though, with, you know, this, with articulating it as an opposition to Sharia is, you know, a Muslim will come up and say to you, well, I fast and I pray. That's all part of Sharia. So you see, the problem is Sharia is not just a code word for bad things. Sharia could encompass so many things that Muslims do and we think are laudable, you know. And I think this is where you can have some difficulties with that distinction.
And I think the point is that if we're really working at this and helping to define not the religious practices, which by some estimates represent 10% of, you know, the body of Sharia, it's really that power piece that is so problematic. And as you've chronicled better than just about anybody, Rabin Ibrahim, all of the murderous and other violent and horrific, barbaric ways in which it is practiced against Muslims as well as against people of other faith. Raymond, let me ask you in closing, you have, for your troubles, your expertise, your writings, your public speaking, and so on, brought down on you the wrath of the Islamists, who are very quick to pillory you, as they are others of us, including myself, as racists and bigots and Islamophobes, a favorite phrase coined by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Just take a minute to talk about what that kind of slander says about not so much you, but about the people who are using it against you.
Well, it says that they have no arguments. It says that they can't take what I say or what you say or what others say. And as I do and as you do and others do, break it down, make our argument, present the evidence. They can't do that. They can't rebut us. So what do you do when you can't rebut? You do ad hominem attacks. You say, you can't trust this guy. He's an evil person. Oh, he's an Islamophobe. Oh, he's a racist. Oh, it's that. And unfortunately, with, you know, lesser minds, that works. I can't trust this guy. He's a bad man.
Or I don't want to be seen in his company, I think is the his kind
yeah,
of
yeah. Or I don't want to deal with him. You know, he's going to bring me down, and I'm going to be associated with him. But if I can close with a kind of a good news thing, and it's kind of an ironic twist, is, you know, this Islamic State and these atrocities that are being committed are, I don't want to say a good thing, but they're eye openings. And I believe a lot of Americans and Europeans in general, it's not because BBC has been broadcasting this or Fox News. It's because of the phenomena of the internet. And the Islamic State itself posts its own images of decapitations and slaughters and murders. And it boasts about it. And people see this, and now people are opening their eyes.
It is a teachable moment, that's for sure. And I hope that it helps teach what you have done so much to instruct all of us in, Raymond Ibrahim, notably with your book, The Al-Qaeda Reader, and more recently, Crucified Again, Exposing Islam's New War on Christians. And I just wanted to say that at the Center for Security Policy, we have adopted a new lapel pin, which is available for sale at securefreedom.org, which takes the symbol that these Islamic State types are painting on the doors of Christians, the Nazrain, I believe they call it, to identify them for the kind of persecution that you've talked about and chronicled so well, Raymond. And I hope that people will adopt this as a symbol of our stand against not just the Islamic State, but all of these global jihadists and their effort to oppress us. Keep up the good work, my friend, at the David Horowitz Freedom Center and all of your other institutional affiliations, and come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.